and welcome to the EI podcast. I'm Paul Lay, senior editor at Engelsberg Ideas, and today I'm delighted to be joined by historian Stephen Bauer, who is the co-author of a new book, Why Machiavelli Matters Now. Stephen is professor of early modern history at the University of Edinburgh, and he's published extensively on the history of Venice in particular and the Renaissance in general. So, welcome, Stephen.
Thank you.
So, as you write in the introduction to the book, Machiavelli is seen as both an angel and a devil to many different figures throughout history. And this word Machiavellian has taken on the mantle of other sinister words like Kafkaesque or Beckettian. And he has persisted in his remarkable influence over the 500 years since his death. But your book very much addresses the question as why Machiavelli matters now. So can you tell me why he does matter now?
Well, that's a good question. It's justifying. Justifying the title of the book. There's a lot of different ways we can take it. One of the things which strikes me about Machiavelli and why he's important now is that a lot of the world in which we live today is really partly shaped by the Renaissance. It's partly shaped by and Machiavelli's contribution to Renaissance ideas and discussions and debates. So I think in order to understand some of the questions which we have now about violence, about the limits of violence, the relationship between violence and morality, for example, Machiavelli was setting out many of was engaging with and setting up many of those questions and exploring some of the answers to those.
So you set up, in a sense, our political agenda that persists to this day.
I think very much so. Yeah. If we find, when you pick up The Prince or another of Machiavelli's works, you find it engaging, accessible, and familiar, as I think many people do, that's partly because we are the inheritors of the cultural changes, rhetorical changes, intellectual changes which came in with the Renaissance and were embraced so enthusiastically and sometimes gingerly, as you refer to the Machiavellian. They're not so keen on that across Europe and then across the world.
So let's get some sense of it, because he's a much mythologized figure, Machiavelli. So Stephen, who was the man behind this all-powerful myth? What's his background? What credentials did he have?
Well, he's born in Florence in 1469 to a not particularly prominent family in the city, although it's quite a good name, quite an ancient and well-established name. But his father had sort of withdrawn a little bit from engagement with politics and so on, and seems to have run up debts. And that partly prevented him really coming to the fore in political terms. But there's some suggestion his father may deliberately have kept out of the hurly-burly and faction fighting of Florence under the Medici.
It's a very factional.
Yes, it is, absolutely. Florentines are good at one thing they're very good at throughout the Middle Ages and Renaissance is falling out with each other and forming factions and different groupings. But Machiavelli is interesting because he seems to be, so maybe thanks to his father's sort of withdrawal, semi-retirement from all that or low profile, Machiavelli is sort of a clean pair of hands. He's not associated with any particular faction. And so when we don't know a great deal about his education or the sort of lost years which lead up to the years in 1498, around 1498, when he's actually elected to position of secretary to the chancery. And so there's a lot of arguments and debates about it. It's perhaps because of this very relative obscurity that he rises to that position.
He's not associated with any one faction.
No, he's really not. He writes a fairly scathing letter about the guys in charge in Florence in 1494 to 98, and that's this friar and prophet Girolamo Savonarola.
Bonfire of the Vanities.
Bonfire of the Vanities and youth. parading through the streets and telling older Florentines off if they're wearing the wrong sorts of clothing or
he's a fascinating character.
Yes, himself. You could have a whole interesting podcast where he writes about tyranny, for example, Savonarola. So he's a very interesting character.
Who comes to a rather unhappier.
Yes, he's both burnt and hanged, simultaneously.
Just make sure.
Yes.
So this image of Florence as this factional place of infighting, does it persist? And once Machiavelli does get somewhere near the levers of power, what's his influence on the city? And how does the city influence his work? I mean, we know the prince is great.
Yes.
His great advice manual to rulers. I mean, how do the two interact?
I mean, that's a very good question, and because he seems to have been quite close to Piero Soderini, and Soderini family were another prominent family in Florence, and Piero Soderini really succeeds as leader in Florence in the interregnum period, as it were, between the Medici domination. This is the first decade of the 16th century. And indeed, those hostile to Machiavelli or to Soderini call Machiavelli Soderini's little puppet or mannequin. So he's very closely associated with Soderini. But what the less Machiavelli watches as Soderini is outmaneuvered by the opposing factions, who are never eradicated, who are always there. And that's a lesson that Machiavelli takes from this. You have to kill the sons of Brutus, he says. He says that Soderini should have seized the opportunity to wipe out his enemies, whether through execution, exile, outmaneuver them. Otherwise, look what happens. They're plotting and they come back and they oust you. So those are some of the lessons that the Machiavelli understood or drew on at his time within the Soderini government. Then more particularly, he's involved with war and foreign relations. And so he learns that, he understands very vividly and immediately how weak Florence is in relation to these great powers like France, the Empire, and so on, who have invaded Italy or have been present in Italy since the end of the 15th century.
Italy itself is...
Italy is divided. Florence is one republic among many, so they're all jostling for power within the peninsula.
And so they can be picked off and superior foreign forces.
Yes, so there's a divide and conquer approach taken by these northern the Italians call them barbarians.
Of course they do.
So Machiavelli is sent out to, as ambassadors or legates do, to lie on behalf of his employers.
So he's a real student of statecraft and diplomacy.
Yes. And he has to stand up there before the king, before the king's counselors and powerful aristocrats in France and justify Florence's position. Yeah. So he learns how to use language effectively to mask Florence's real motives or to present Florence's maneuverings in the best possible light. I think,
It's interesting. You mentioned the example of Brutus there.
Yes.
It's full of classical references.
Yes.
And of course, he is a Renaissance figure who looks back to the classical age for influence. I wonder how much does that permeate his work?
It's hugely important. I mean, many of the models he uses for his writing are adapted from classical models. Yeah. So, for example, he's a writer of comedies and
we forget that.
It's sometimes overlooked. And his comedy, Mandragola, the Mandrake Root, is sometimes described as the prince in dramatic form because so many of the themes of the prince can be detected in this comedy Mandragola, but it's also very funny. It manages still to be a very funny play, but he models that on the works of Plautus, for example, one of the ancient dramatists. He gives it his own twist, but he takes a lot of that framework and structure and runs with it. That's what makes him interesting. He's not just a dry imitator of these classical models. He really does inventive and exciting things with them.
And we always talk about the prince, and we'll have to talk about it. But is there in any sense, a precursor to that? What are the influences that go into The Prince? Or is it this kind of sui generis?
Yes. There have been, as you know, as many people know, there's been a huge debate about that and a huge discussion about that. There are certain figures, you know, Quentin Skinner and others, for example, who've really said, well, this is a kind of twist to classical republicanism that what he's doing here. Then there's a kind of opposing wing, if you like, who Harvey Mansfield, for example, and others, who are see Machiavelli's doing something radically different. He's introducing evil, immorality, if not immorality, into political discourse, which is totally at odds with the classical model that he's adapting or adopting.
And you write, these are your words or Alex's perhaps, Machiavelli challenges us to learn to see clearly.
Yes.
He casts a very cold eye on things, does he? And not take refuge in warm and empty words, utopian platitudes, and universal panaceas.
Yes.
I wonder if therefore, and he does succeed in those ambitions by and large, I think we probably agree. Mm-hmm. Does it give him the right to be called the first realist in the history of modern political thought? This is by the time we get to modern political thought. Hence, you were talking about his persistent.
Yes. I don't think we say he's the first realist, or I don't think we say that, but some people, it has been said.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say so, no. Mm. I would say there are others, there are people who are writing about, you know, the nature of, you know, expediency and the flexible morality in political life. Mm. I think he's not absolutely the first to do that.
Mm.
But he does it, and I think partly the way he does it is part of the reason for his success.
Mm. And how does he do it?
Well, he does it in an interesting way. It's almost like a puzzle. He will often give a statement of political reality, as it were, and you're kind of nodding along, going, "Yes, I agree with that. That makes a lot of sense." But then he'll immediately, or very quickly, within a sentence or two, maybe challenge that, or qualify that, or reverse direction. And then explain, but he doesn't. So he challenges you. You sort of almost feel him saying, "Well, keep up," you know. And that's that's what we meant when we say that he uses that challenge to encourage you not to accept the easiest explanation, to avoid panaceas, to avoid the easy way out. He's saying you need to develop. He's challenging you to develop your own skepticism, your own sharp intellect, to be able to distinguish between the platitudes that are in circulation in your own time, as in his time, and to make your own mind up, looking at the facts as they can be detected.
And The Prince is still read, still influential, 500 years on. It works in that broad sense of anyone who's interested in politics, in political action, in statecraft, in diplomacy. But I wonder if we could just focus on who he was writing it for at the time. It's obviously become universal. It's one of those classics books that people refer to again and again, and will do so. But who was he actually writing it for when he put pen to paper?
I like to think it's very much for fellow Florentines. Yeah. I get a strong... often people with The Prince, they will leap on to the example, say, of Cesare Borgia, and say Cesare Borgia is a kind of archetypal prince, you know, successful man, and so on. Others will say he's the anti-type of a prince. In the end, he's unsuccessful in his ambitions, but he comes closest to that figure who uses his virtù, his qualities, various qualities to grapple with fortuna, with fortune, and try and turn it as far as any human can, turn it his way. But there is also, of course, the exhortation at the end of The Prince, which is really to the Medici, who are the dedicatee of the prince. Some have argued at that last chapter, which is this exhortation to the Medici to throw these barbarians out of Italy and to unite Italy, and sees that moment when they seem very powerful on the peninsula. To some have seen that as a sort of insincere or a late addition, or just as a means of trying to get himself back into government, into their good books, and into some sort of position. But I really do feel that all the way through the prince, he's speaking, he's thinking about his he loved Florence. That was the thing he said, I love more than my soul. And he was Florentine through and through. And I think primarily in his mind and head, he's writing for his fellow Florentines.
And if you could summarize Machiavelli's core political dictums, as we might say, what do you think they'd be? What's the deep philosophy that is the prince? And I wonder if we could talk as well about what he means by republicanism as well. When we talk about classical republicanism, it's we think of republicanism very simply as a rule without a monarch. It's much more complex than that. And we've seen their influence not just in Florence but in Britain too, in the United States. This influence of classical republicanism, your historian of Venice, nowhere was it embodied more than in Renaissance Venice. What are we talking about with those ideals of classical republicanism?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned the Venice example. He was very scathing about Venice. Everyone else in the 16th century is saying, oh, Venice, it's wonderful. In England, Elizabethan England, you've got John Harrington and others saying, if only we had a Doge and so on. If we could only imitate Venice, we could have their incredible serenity and harmony as well and be so successful. Machiavelli was, and this gets us to the core of his philosophy, I think this is why I bring it up. Machiavelli is totally dismissive and he says, look, conflict, you can't, the Venetians pretend they have this political setup which irons out and removes conflict and is all about harmony. This is rubbish. The conflict is unavoidable in human society. Humans are always, and he wrote poetry about ambition. He wrote poems on ambition, on these basic human emotions and forces and drives in nature. So we've got to accept that we're not utopians. We are coming back to that, our quote again.
And that really,
so we have to accept that conflict is there. We need to work out a way to channel that conflict, and in a republican setting there's particular things and ways he had in mind of doing that.
It's very interesting reading near contemporaries, more contemporary, like Hobbes, for example, great early modern English philosopher. The influence is there already, and I think particularly when Hobbes writes about religion and the dangers of religion, which seems to me to be very Machiavellian there. And I think it's almost, you can't really think about Renaissance Italy, Renaissance Florence, the city-states, Venice, I'd include that as well, without considering the role of religion. And I just wonder if you could give us some sense of the way that Machiavelli conceives of religion, of God. And what his beliefs were, his personal beliefs.
Again, this is a question being fraught with huge disagreement and debate.
That's why we love it.
I would say he is very much a problem, not so much with religion, but with the religious, the people who claim to represent religion. He writes in a way about the popes, which we don't see again, I think, until Gibbon and others, who are absolutely dismissive and scathing of their venality and their corruption. This is partly, of course, because the popes had declared war on Florence a few times, so he was slightly irked by that. But he saw religion as having religion is very useful, and I don't think he just meant that in a cynical, utilitarian sense. He saw religion as very useful at binding a society, especially societies which were, they had their laws, or they were developing their laws. They'd been recently founded, but it really, to make a society, you need more than a constitution. You need more than laws. You need a faith. You need to have faith in something. And I think his idea of religion and his idea of republicanism in that civic Florentine setting or the city-state setting of the Renaissance are inextricably bound. And I think he's certainly not an atheist, in case anyone was wondering.
Talking of Hobbes, that was an accusation often used, but
yes,
atheist has a slightly different meaning in 15th century and 16th century, but perhaps it does now. But this idea of virtue, it's a word that constantly comes up in Machiavelli's political philosophy, but it doesn't mean simply virtue.
No,
we can't translate it as such, like a kind of moral goodness.
Yes.
I wonder if you could define it in some way.
Yes.
It's quite challenging. And why it's such an important concept to Machiavelli.
Yes. I think it's an important concept because it allows him, his focus on this idea of virtù and this exploration of the range of qualities required for virtù, which are sometimes around physical, which do include elements of physical bravery, I think, but also are about foresight and planning. They're also about the ability to have animo. I think animo is a part of is connected with virtù. It's the idea of being able to act quickly in response to the rapidly changing nature of a situation. So I think it's really at the core of it allows Machiavelli to break free and break out of some of the boxes into which political life and political figures have been put and say, well, even women can, you know, what is it about the relationship between gender and virtù is interesting. Is there anything, can a woman have virtù? And really, in Machiavellian terms, she can. There's nothing that's related to virtù, that's connected with virtù that a woman cannot have. For example, commanding armies can be part of virtù. Well, he cites examples of women who are commanders of armies, leaders, queens, and others. And really, so that I find that quite that's a really interesting side of virtù, the way it breaks down a lot of these very traditional established boxes. And again, it's part of this aim that he has to let us see, to make sure we see things more clearly, we understand, we brush aside the boxes, the platitudes, the structures which maybe limit our viewpoints, limit our understanding.
No, he will forever be known as the author of The Prince.
Yes.
But as you've already hinted at, there's a great deal more to his writing than The Prince, however important and foundational it is. I wonder if you could talk about those other major works of his and how they relate to The Prince, how they relate to his political philosophy, his biography.
Yes, so this, I guess the second major work is The Discourses, which is written a few years after The Prince. So he's writing this around 1517, 1819, when he is, when the Medici are, or their proxies are in control in Florence. And Machiavelli seems to be associated with a group which meets in the Rucellai Gardens, is meeting in these gardens to discuss ideas of republicanism, republican ideals. And some of the people from that group later on are involved in plots or accused of plotting against the Medici. So there's always been this question mark about where Machiavelli's loyalties lie. But in The Discourse, he's very much moving on. In some ways, it shares a lot with The Prince. Some people have sometimes said, well, The Discourses shows the Republican Machiavelli, The Prince shows the princely Machiavelli, someone who sees the prince as the way to bring in stability and to organize a state. But The Discourses does share some characteristics with the prince, but is really much more concerned about the institutions rather than individuals. Mm. So that's The Discourses is a much longer, important book. And to come back to your earlier point, it's a really interesting meditation and engagement with Livy. So it's again stimulated by the classics and by his reading of the classics.
And what does he take from Livy?
Well, he's fascinated by Livy's account of the rise and, I guess, corruption of the Roman Republic. And he's fascinated by what Livy says about that. He wants to learn the lessons. How can Florence has gone down the wrong path, it seems. You know, Rome was successful in many ways. Its republic for a long time was successful until it wasn't. Yeah. And he wants to learn lessons from that and say, well, can we get back onto that track of republicanism? Maybe we can learn something from the Roman example to do that.
And what do you think he was trying to express there? What should the leaders of Florence learn from the discourses?
I think he was, one of the things he's saying to the people of Florence is that it's addressing this question of factions and saying that the faction fighting in Florence has undermined it's pulling the civic politics apart. Mm. It's not constructive. It's not helpful.
No.
And so look at Rome was able to direct and channel the energies of the people through the tribunes who worked successfully together with the more elevated sort in the Republic in order to, for a time, to lay the foundations for the greatness, the right expansion of Rome. So perhaps if the Florentines paused a minute and stopped angling to do down their enemies and to attack those, the better sort, they might also be successful.
So he's a historian as well.
Oh, yes, yes, very much. He signs off one of his letters as Machiavelli Storico, historian. He's very proud of being a historian.
What did Machiavelli's contemporaries think of him? I'm thinking in particular of the Medici, the leaders of Florence. What was their opinion of this man who, if we go back to the old stereotype of Machiavelli, he's trying to manipulate them in some way.
Yes, he had his enemies, certainly. We know that certain members of the old aristocratic aristocratic families, for want of a better word, didn't like him. They thought he was jumped up, and they write about him in quite a disparaging way. I can't remember the word they use, something like it's impudent man or something. Mm-hmm. What the Medici thought about him is absolutely fascinating. We don't know enough about that. And that relationship is a very interesting one. There's suggestions that Machiavelli as a youth was very close to Giulio de' Medici, who's later cardinal and then pope, a disastrously unsuccessful pope, it must be said, Pope Clement VII. So I think the Medici probably were wary. I suspect for a long time they were wary of Machiavelli. He was too clever by half, too sharp, and they were a little bit worried about him. But in the end, they brought him back as a historian. So the Giulio de' Medici, Cardinal Giulio, asked them to write the Florentine histories. So that's another one of his great works, which is very neglected, I think, more broadly. And they did bring him back to do things like inspect the fortresses of Florence in the 1525-26. And he's also connected with the papal army as well. So they do recognize that his skills and experience, they can turn to their advantage.
So he has a significant status.
Yes, I think so. Yes, absolutely. Yes, in his time, so the prince is copied out in manuscript fairly early on, so there's a demand for it. And then when his comedies come out, we have letters, people writing saying, have you heard the latest comedy by Machiavelli, and people writing to each other asking for copies of it. So he had a status as a wit, as a sharp, someone with sharp repartee, as an improviser. He's known to improvise poetry and sing and strum his lyre at parties and so on. So he's quite an entertaining figure, I think.
So he's a skilled courtier in this way, like a Castiglione or something.
Yes, absolutely. He does have to kiss the Pope's foot. I always think that's a wonderful image, that the great Machiavelli having to stoop down as ambassador, as legate. He's a sort of second-tier ambassador, as legate to the Pope, and you do have to kiss the Pope's foot. And I'm not sure how Machiavelli probably thought, I have to do this for my country, but he was probably thinking this Pope isn't such a smooth operator.
And he has this status in Florence. He's very influential. When do his ideas start spreading beyond Florence? Because he is a hugely significant figure,
yes,
in Western civilization, and no doubt beyond.
Yes.
When does it start spreading beyond
Florence? Almost immediately. And we have a version of the Prince comes out, as a sort of adaptation of the Prince comes out in 1519, 1520.
So that's he's writing at the right time, isn't he, with print?
Yes, absolutely. Within 6 years. Although, of course, a lot of the copies, the Prince isn't in print until 15, in Italian, until 1532. So that's about 15 years where it's circulating as manuscript copies. And the similar diffusion, of course, to England or to the English-speaking world, including Scotland, I would have to say, by manuscript for about a century, because it's not printed in English, it's not translated in English until the middle of the 17th century. So that's incredible. That's as if Charles Darwin's Ascent of Man, Origin of Species, had been left unpublished, you know, circulated in manuscript for a century and a half.
And why was that?
Well, it's a hot potato. Hmm. It is definitely a hot potato. We have comments from English courtiers and religious figures like Cardinal Reginald Poole,
let's face it,
hates mostly everything, but definitely hates Machiavelli, condemning its immorality. They see it as an attack on the church. They don't like what he says about the Pope, about the papacy, and about papal power and corruption. So it is, whether in the Prince or in the Florentine Histories or in some of his other works.
And would you say that there's any particular place or period where it really has been significantly influential, that it's changed the course of history, or has been crucial to a particular political figure?
I guess you could make a case for 16th century France. There is, of course, in France, from the middle of the 16th century, the wars of religion. So these between the Huguenots and the Catholics, and the Huguenot and Catholic powerful families. And of course, at this time, the regent is Catherine de' Medici, an Italian, yep, someone of Florentine birth and yep, extraction. And she is her actions around the Bartholomew's Day massacre, or her supposed role in that massacre of Huguenots, is linked by many people to the agenda, the lessons of Machiavelli, that she's just enacting that violent, that kind of ruthless, immoral political behavior to further her own ends. And I think that's when we see this particular bitter twist and turn in the image of, and the word Machiavellian, and the image of Machiavelli, which is then displayed across the Channel in England on the stage. And so you have the murderous Machiavelli that is mentioned in Richard the Third, and you have other playwrights and dramatists who are using the figure of Machiavelli as the epitome of evil.
Mm. And every time there's a move on a politician, or someone tries to succeed or topple anyone, the word Machiavellian is almost routinely employed. It's almost like a trigger reaction. We just know that Machiavellian will be used. What is it we get wrong about that word Machiavellian?
What do we get wrong? That's a difficult question. It's understood as an expediency which is almost divorced from the idea of consequences, or it's I do think Machiavelli is much more aware of the dangers of acting for what could be seen as immoral ends. He's not really saying that's the best thing to do. So he's saying sometimes that's unavoidable in certain situations, under certain conditions.
So he's a realist in that sense.
Yes, yes. I don't think he's saying you must all go out there and you must do this. This is part of the... But you must be prepared, if necessary, to do this. But I think there's always a caveat around the way he talks about it. But be aware that that won't necessarily make you glorious, won't necessarily make you popular, and it won't necessarily be a very long-lasting success. I think you'd say those sorts of people don't often last very long, those who are using expediency in that way.
And when you look at his great political rising now, as your book says, Why Machiavelli Matters Now, what is it that you would like to tell modern democratic politicians that they could learn, that they could take from a reading of The Prince or the discourses?
I think the one thing above all that Machiavelli would say is don't take the people for granted. And I think now there's sometimes a feeling that our leaders, politicians, underestimate the intelligence of the electorate, and that's obviously a much more complex relationship between people and power and democracies, a bit more complex than it was in Machiavelli's day, when it was a much more restricted access to formal power. But I think, yeah, he'd say that people have huge power, and he would say that should be that's the warning gives you. You need to respect that power and use it very carefully.
And that, again, presumably, is a lesson learned from his classical background.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Well, that's fantastic, Stephen. That's really brilliant tour d'horizon, I think, of Machiavelli's work. There is so much more to say, and it's all in Why Machiavelli Matters Now, which was written by Stephen Bird and Alexander Lee, an old friend of AI. So thank you so much for taking us through that. It was brilliant. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the AI podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please sign up to our mailing list and download the Engelsberg Ideas app. Explore intelligent perspectives on history, culture, and geopolitics anytime, anywhere. And best of all, it's totally free. Until next time, thanks for listening.